Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right of the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. On to our next guest. It's Gareth Porter the Great, independent historian and journalist, primarily for Interpress Service at ipsnews.net. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks very much for having me again.
Very happy to have you here. This will be interview part six on Gareth's brand new book, Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And we're basically going through chapter by chapter here. Thanks very much. You're very gracious with your time and your expertise on the show. I want to know.
I think we're setting some sort of a record for a radio interview on a book.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and on this subject too. I mean, yeah. Give me a break. Is there anything like it in world history? Probably not.
So,
let's see. I've interviewed you when we changed with the date in the title. It ruined it. But it used to be that the title of each interview at entry at scotthorton.org, it would say Gareth Porter number 125, Gareth mm-hmm. Porter number 126, for using the same title over and over again, right? So we lost track somewhere right around 150. And then probably, I don't know, what about half of those are on Iran? And then, of course, lots on Iraq and Afghanistan and other issues as well. But, we sure have covered this a lot. And I'm still learning all kinds of things, and that's why I have you on, because I want to know this stuff at least almost as well as you do, because, it's very interesting to me, and of course, it's a very important issue for peace on planet Earth and all of that, too, so now the best I can do is read what you write and interview you about it. Manufactured Crisis, everybody, go and buy this book, would you? In fact, buy 10 of them and give them to people that you know and care about and are associated with and have met before. Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. All right, now, this chapter 7, is IAEA comes up empty. And I just love the way you did this. You just, case after case, I almost want to feel sad and a little bit empathetic with the IAEA guys. I can sort of see why they might be suspicious. Oh, I think we got them on this one. And then just case after case after case of hyped up accusation after hyped up accusation about Iran's nuclear program falling to pieces once all the documents are finally come forward. So just take us through it, because I think people remember, if anything, they're confused because, man, don't they know that Iran has a nuclear weapons program? We're surprised they haven't nuked us all to death already, Gareth, because they've been making nuke bombs for years, I heard. And what it is what everybody heard is each and every one of these stories standing alone as more smoking gun evidence of what these guys have been up to that we've heard over the last decade.
Yeah, I mean, this whole story about the IAEA investigation of Iran's nuclear program that began really around late 2003, I guess you could say, is the starting point, and went up until the beginning of 2008 or the end of 2007, is really a very important part of the whole narrative, because, you know, that's like 4 years of steady drip, drip, drip of stories. Like, you know, every 3 months you get an IAEA report that for a period of time nothing new was coming out, but for a while in 2004, 2005, you had a series of reports that, you know, almost every new report had something new that cast suspicion on the Iranian nuclear program because of some kind of issue that had arisen because of a discovery, you know, that the IAEA had made about some activity that had taken place, or a suspicion about one of the documents. They varied in terms of how it came about, but, you know, you've got one case after another where the IAEA was suspicious of something that had happened or that Iran had turned over to them, and decided that they were going to launch an investigation. And as you say, I mean, they clearly thought they were going to come up with some evidence in one or more of these cases that would indicate that, you know, they had evidence of a nuclear weapons program, and in every case, they had a negative in the end. So, yeah, I mean, this is an important part of the whole storyline that in my book, which is that, you know, they did everything possible to come up with any shred of evidence that they could use to indict Iran as having a nuclear weapons program, and it was a failure all along the line.
Yeah, it's just like I remember my friend back in 02 talking about, before the war in Iraq, but talking about the case for a war with Iraq and saying, you know, if you give each one of these a 1 or a 0, first of all, for even being true or not, but even accepting that they're true, give them a 1 or a 0 for whether they're good enough as an excuse to go to war, you end up with 0 times 10, maybe 0 times 20. Boy, that's a lot of excuses, but none of them are good enough. In this case, it's the same kind of thing with this evidence where it's just, you know, 0 times 20, you know, nothing but endless accusations, lots and lots of smoke, but then, oh, you know what, that's not even smoke, that's steam. There's no fire at all.
Steam is good. Steam is good.
That's terrible. All right, so let's go through this. Laser enrichment, what are they doing with their lasers then, Gareth, huh? Defend that.
Laser enrichment was, of course, something that that they had started to look at in 2003, and you know, this was part of the report that was put out in late 2003. They were reporting on the fact that Iran had carried out both centrifuge enrichment and laser enrichment, and we've talked about this before, over a period of nearly two decades, was the general impression that was given. In fact, if you look very carefully at the IAEA report that was issued first in November 2003 and then later in early 2004, the first one on the centrifuge very specifically, and the second one adding an important detail on the laser enrichment, what you found, if you read those reports carefully, is that there was no real enrichment taking place, before these reports were written. That in fact, the only thing that had happened was that they had tested the centrifuges with uranium, which is the only way you can do it, to make sure that they actually would work before they intended to actually begin any enrichment. And by that time, as we've talked about before, in fact, they had not enriched any uranium. So that's what they reported in late 2003. And in the spring, I forget the exact date, 2004, they added a very important detail on the laser enrichment program, which was that, in fact, they did some experiments, but that, in fact, the experiments failed to achieve the result, which was the minimum necessary to have a viable program. It was like only one-third of the enrichment that was necessary that was actually achieved, and they basically realized that it wasn't going to work, so they had to give it up. That's what was actually reported in the 2004 report.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then so what about the highly enriched uranium? I remember this one being a real big deal back in the Bush years there, 2004 or 2005. About, man, they didn't say weapons grade 90 something, really above 94% to make a bomb out of it. They didn't say that, but they said highly enriched uranium and no reasonable explanation for this.
Right. Now this was a very important one, because this was the first time that they thought that they had caught the Iranians doing high enriched uranium, HEU. And what happened was that when the Iranians tested their the centrifuges at the Calais Electric Company in mid-2003, you know, they had made some low-enriched uranium there, but the IAEA, when they took environmental samples, found traces of HEU, high-enriched uranium. And so almost immediately, the IAEA put out a report saying, oh, look, we found evidence of HEU. This looks really bad. And it can't be, as you said, it can't be explained by anything that the Iranians have claimed. Now, the Iranians said almost immediately that this must be some imported parts that were contaminated. That was the explanation that they gave, and the IAEA safeguards department people, who, of course, as I think I've indicated on your show, and we'll talk about it again, I'm sure, are really hardliners. The first one, Goldschmidt, was somebody who had criticized El Baradei for refusing to refer in his IAEA report in September 2004 and June 2004 to the satellite photos that John Bolton wanted to have referred to in that report. In other words, you have Goldschmidt siding with Bolton in an issue where it was not real evidence of nuclear weapons intent or anything of the sort. It was simply photos of conventional, of potentially conventional explosives facilities. And so, you know, that indicates Goldschmidt's bent, and I talk about that in the book. And then you've got Ali Heinonen, who, you know, did not like the Iranians, did not trust the Iranians, and did everything possible to try to find evidence to show that they were having a nuclear weapons program. And this is a very good example of it. So Heinonen and Goldschmidt were still determined that they were going to prove that the Iranians, in this case, had produced high-enriched uranium, and that must be evidence of a nuclear weapons program. Well, to cut to the chase here, it turns out that they finally had to call in an external group of specialists, and I think the circumstantial evidence is that El Baradei and his allies realized that Heinonen and Goldschmidt were really working against the interests of an objective investigation here, and they couldn't be trusted with this issue. And so they called in some external specialists to look at the evidence, and the external specialists very quickly came to the conclusion that this was indeed a case of contamination of parts that had come from abroad, that the Iranians had been telling the truth.
Right. And I remember that from back then, too. That, it turned out just like they had tried to explain, this came from the Pakistani equipment that we bought. They
This apparently was not the Pakistani one. This was apparently Russian. Russian.
Well, there were two different ones.
Yeah, there were two different ones.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back with Gareth Porter in just a sec. Manufactured Crisis is the book. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up. Turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
All right, commercial break. Get out of my way. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. He wrote Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. Now for sale at a website near you. Just type it in, Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. And we were talking about the highly enriched uranium residue on some Iranian equipment that Ali Heinonen and I forgot his first name, Goldsmith, that they thought was going to be such a big deal, and it turned out not to be. And it was, the 36% stuff came from Russia, and then the 56% stuff came from Pakistan, from the AQ Khan network. Is
I believe
that correct?
That's correct,
and then,
yes.
And yeah. Which piece was which? Does it matter?
Not really.
Okay. All right, let's go on. So, and then the telexes. Now, just before, just a few weeks ago, before I got the book, I guess after the book was out, you wrote a piece about this, and I interviewed you about it, so maybe we can give this a little bit of short shrift here. But this
yeah.
is another one where you could really see how some CIA guys might go, wow, look at seven things in a row that are dual-use items. I think maybe there's a front operation going on for the Iranian military here, but you say not only is it not right, but is it that they really should have known better, too, Gareth?
Well, of course they should have known better. I mean, you know, this is a clear case of, you know, a little small tidbit or a few tidbits of ambiguous evidence. I mean, how can it be more ambiguous than dual use equipment or dual use technology? All of these cases that the intelligence analysts had in front of them, these telexes, involved the effort to procure either you know some bottles of fluorine that can be used in you know a nuclear program, but obviously can be used for you know innumerable other applications, and the same thing for the other types of technology or equipment that were at issue here. I mean, you know, there's no inherent reason to go off half-cocked and say this is evidence of a nuclear program, except, as I've, you know, argued in the chapter that we'll get to later, that the intelligence community was primed to try to find information or analysis that would support the policy of the United States that suspected that Iran was trying to get nuclear weapons. So that's what was really going on. Now, in addition to that ambiguous evidence that I've just referred to of dual-use equipment being procured on these telexes, there was also the telephone or the telex number of this physics research center, which, you know, Iran never denied the fact that that was a defense ministry-related outfit. So, you know, that was seen as the smoking gun. Oh, you've got the telex number. That must mean the military is using, you know, Sharif University, which was ostensibly where the these things were being ordered for. They're using for Sharif University as a front to carry out a military nuclear program. And that became the sort of mainstream idea that supported the policy of the United States to accuse Iran of intention of having nuclear weapons for a full decade during the 1990s. And it turned out, as the IAEA finally found out in 2007-2008, when the Iranians turned over all of the documents at the end of the work plan that had been agreed in 2007 with El-Baradei, it turned out that, in fact, the head of the, for the former head of the PHRC, Physics Research Center, had been a faculty member of Sharif University and had been asked by all these other faculty members to help them get things for their students and for their own research. And the documentation was impeccable. The IAEA could not question any of it. So this closed the books on this. Unfortunately, as I've suggested on your show, I think, before, David Albright continues to try to put out the idea that that this is evidence of a secret military nuclear weapons program.
Right. All right, now,
still doing it today.
Well, why not? indeed. So now I want to talk about the mine and the suspicions of military involvement in
yeah.
opening up a new mine instead of expanding the old mine and this kind of thing they thought was suspicious. But also, I'd like you to focus, if you could, for us a second on this uranium metal document, which you
oh, yeah.
say is sort of how to the engineering document for how to make hemispheres for a uranium nuke, but it's not the specific engine manufacturer documents of exactly how to do it. But so what is the significance of this?
Yeah.
Where did they get it, and what were they doing with it? Doesn't it say that they're guilty of something or something?
Right. No, this comes back to the episode that we discussed, I think, on the last program, or maybe it was the one before, where, you know, the Iranians were dealing with the AQCON network, trying to get a centrifuge technology, trying to get the blueprints for centrifuges and some parts to see how it worked. And the AQCON network threw in to the deal this 15-page paper, one page of which had the sort of general outline, the general outline of how you would create the hemispheric structure that is part of the process of building the contraption which you'd use for nuclear weapon. This is a formed metal, a uranium metal form that is part of a nuclear weapons apparatus. So what the AQCON network was doing was trying to interest them in buying the actual specs, the specifications for how to do this. This was basically an advertisement for that. It had none of the detail that would be necessary in order to know how to do it.
So in other words, it's just the same old answer, is they have it because we drove them to the black market to get the equipment for their civilian nuclear program, which is safeguarded and verified and everything
general,
else.
That's right.
It came from the salesman from that black market.
It came from the salesman, and I asked Heinonen, when I interviewed him, did anybody ever contradict the Iranian position that they did not ask for this? He told me no, nobody ever contradicted them.
And never mind any credible assertion that they did anything with it, or, you know, have a secret stash of uranium that they've diverted somewhere and that they've been practicing with the metallurgy involved in
actually
forming.
No, nobody has ever claimed, the IAEA and Ali Heinonen never claimed anything of the sort. In fact, Heinonen, when he initially addressed this question in a briefing, if I remember correctly, for member states, he was quite forthright about it. He said, no, look, this is not a blueprint for a nuclear weapon. It's not something that can actually be used to build a nuclear weapon. It's something much far short of that. And so he's basically saying, don't get too excited about it. But, you know, I think the politics of this were such that he changed his mind. And one has to believe that he talked to the Israelis and the Americans, and they convinced him that he should, you know, beat the drum about it, because that's what he ended up doing. And so it was turned into a political issue, despite the fact that he knew very well that it was not, you know, there was no real significance to that document.
All right, now we got to skip the mine, but suffice to say that the mine and the plutonium and those two specifically, those were just dropped as issues, which we can only conclude means that they were satisfied. They just didn't really say anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good indication, I should say, a good indication that essentially Heinonen was encouraged clearly by the Israelis, because the Israelis were the ones who knew that there was a connection between the Gashin mine and this firm called Kimya Madan, which they intended to introduce into the laptop document. Mm-hmm. So they wanted the IAEA to launch an investigation of the Gashin mine, and specifically the ore processing part of the mine operation. And that's because, as I say, they had already caught on to Kimya Madan having a contract for that ore processing center, and they had a document that linked Kimya Madan to some procurement request for something that was a dual-use technology, but that they were going to argue was very incriminating. So that's the origin of why, otherwise, mysteriously, the IAEA wanted to look into this Gashin mine. Nobody could figure out why they would want to do so, because there was no indication that there was anything amiss about it. There was no indication that Iran had told a fib about the mine or anything like that. But it turns out, we know from Jackie Sanders, the U.S. representative to the IAEA at that point, in a speech, she later said, well, we think maybe it's not clear whether the Iranian military was really in control of this mine. So that was the secret agenda that was at stake in that. And as you said, I mean, you know, the IAEA found nothing to support that idea. In fact, by 2007, well before 2007, Iran had turned over documents which showed very clearly that there was no military involvement in the Qashin mine. The Kimya Madan was simply made up of people who had worked for the civilian Atomic Energy Organization on the ore processing.
All right, now, and then the next interview will be all about the alleged studies. That's the next chapter of the book here. But we got to end up with, to finish up this chapter here very quickly, Gareth, El Baradei had this so-called work plan with the Iranians where by the end, you say, of 2007, they had resolved all of these issues, and that's the same time that the NIC put out the National Intelligence Estimate saying that the CIA and the American government was satisfied that they didn't have a nuclear weapons program at all there, and you showed just how panicked the Americans were about that, about these issues being resolved when they want them to be outstanding
issues. Yeah, this is one of the things that I'm proudest of about the book, is that I was able to show that through the documents, the WikiLeaks cables,
right,
that the U.S. Was very determined to prevent the work plan success from having any political impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just goes to show what they're about. And then, of course, it's interesting that it's Jeffrey Pyatt, who is now the ambassador to Ukraine during this current crisis, is one of the guys quoted in there. And again,
right,
thanks to Chelsea Manning for leaking those documents.
Yes,
people
indeed,
should never
yeah.
forget, how grateful we got to be for the source of thousands and thousands of great news stories that have come out of those docs and proof of suspicions like yours that have come out of those documents. And
indeed.
So, all right, with that, I'll let you go, and I'll thank you very much for your time. And I will have you on KPFK on Sunday to cover the alleged studies documents and the smoking laptop. Gareth, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Appreciate it. All right, everybody, that is Gareth the Great, Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, and he writes at ipsnews.net and at truthout.org, and he won the Gellhorn Prize. And he will be my guest on Sunday morning on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and then probably, I don't know, next Monday and Tuesday. We're going to cover this whole damn book. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Hey, y'all, Sky here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good. investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship, Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org.